This is the Patty Vasquez Show.
Follow me on Twitter, Patty Vasquez,
on 720 WGN.
Some people see the revolution, but most only see the girl. I can lose my hard-earned freedom if my fear defines my world. I declare my independence from the critics and the stones. I can find my revolution. I can learn to stand alone.
Hey, everybody. Happy Thursday night. We hope that you're happy, healthy, and safe wherever you are tonight. And we encourage you to join our show anytime because this is your conversation. You can call or text 312-981-7200. We've got a lot of topics coming up. We also have some of our friends from the Refugee Theater production of Hands on a Hard Body, which sounds naughty, but it's not. It's about one of those promotions where you have to keep your hand on a pickup truck or a car, and the last person with their hand on the car wins. And we're going to find out more about that in just a little bit. We also are going to hear from Jason Warrior, who's launching a tour. You might have seen him on The Voice or The Four, and an incredibly talented young man from right here in Chicago. We look forward to talking to him. And in studio right now with us is a gentleman who maybe many of you recognize. And I called you gentleman. Is that okay, Abden?
A guy? You know, just stretch the definition of gentleman. That's fine.
A guy from the neighborhood. From over by there. From my old neighborhood, but as a matter of fact. You live in Norwood
Your
Park.
Current neighborhood, right?
I live in Jeff Park.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah, so. I love Norwood Park. And you have been a journalist. You were a writer for the Sun-Times.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've known each other for a few years, and you had told me a couple years ago that you had worked on the R. Kelly story. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm one of those people that thought, okay, you know, this was a devastating situation in the early 2000s. And, you know, I think a lot of us thought, okay, well, you know, he went to trial, and, you know, whatever happened in that situation, it became background noise, didn't it? We all kind of let it go. Yeah. And even when you were writing about it, you met a lot of resistance, didn't you? From fans and from, of course, his camp.
Yeah. When Jim DeRogatis and I, our rock critic, and I started writing these stories, it was 19 years ago. We did our first story December 21 of 2000. And it was really hard to get our fellow journalists to take it seriously. You know, this is before the Me Too movement. So a story about what can be known as a sex tape with, you know, R. Kelly, beloved local, you know, R&B superstar, the biggest R&B superstar in Chicago since Curtis Mayfield, sexually abusing a 14-year-old girl. It was easy to, you know, brush it off, make it a joke. You know, oh, what? You got something against a sex tape? And it's really not a sex tape. This is a rape tape. This is a grown man sexually abusing a 14-year-old girl. And it was just hard. A lot of the rest of the media did not pick it up.
Where were you getting the information in these stories? Where had the tape become public or accessed?
We started when, you know, Jim had been hearing for a long time in the community the way R. Kelly functions. This is, you know, at the end of every concert that, you know, you have all these 19, 20, 21-year-old women, you know, around him, and he'd always be interested in the one, you know, 14-year-old girl in the corner, and he'd have someone in his entourage, you know, he'd write down his phone number, and they'd hand a crumpled up piece of paper to her, and then he'd you know, hook up with her later. And so then we became aware there'd actually been some lawsuits filed by some of these girls who said that, you know, he'd encourage them to, like, drop out of school so they could hang out at the studio with him, and it wasn't ostensibly to help their career, you know, become musical superstars, right. But it wasn't. It was for his convenience of you know, having sex with them. And so we started writing about these lawsuits. And once we started writing, we got a lot more information, you know, people calling us. And we would go out there and just ring doorbells and talk to people and try and get more of them to talk to us. And then we became aware of this tape of his 14-year-old goddaughter and him. And it was a long tape. And, you know, it became known as a sex tape, but it's so much more than sex. It is a grown man disrespecting in so many different ways this young girl, and it's not like she's enjoying herself. He's directing her. What's become clear in the last 19 years, the whole his skill at, you know, manipulating young women. You know, he whispers instructions to their ear to do exactly what he wants them to do. So this tape, you know, we wrote stories about it. It became the basis for the charges against him back in 2002. For they charged him with child pornography, in part because the tape was not dated, so they couldn't know the exact date on which this happened. So instead of charging statutory rape, they thought it'd be easier to charge him with child pornography. It's the same penalties, you know, same jail time and fines. And then began the longest prosecution I have ever covered in the Cook County criminal courts. It went, you know, more than 6 years. Did not come to trial till 2008. And to many people's surprise, he was acquitted. And then 11 more years of him, you know, abusing and, you know, sexually abusing young girls until, you know, Jim DeRogatis, who at that point in the last couple of years, you know, Jim and I had both left the Sun-Times. You know, Jim's teaching journalism at Columbia, but still had been following the Kelly case and still writing for various publications. So he started doing some stories in the last couple of years about R. Kelly's current situation, where he has some women who he had met when they were underage, but now they're of age. But it's being kept in almost cult-like conditions where their parents are calling Jim saying, "We can't see our daughter. We haven't seen our daughter in 2 years. They won't, you know, take our calls. R. Kelly's taking them away from us." Trying to get the police to go there and do wellness checks. And now the girls, they're of age. They tell the police, "I'm fine. I want to be here." And the police say, "Well, what more can we do?" But what really, you know, is sort of changed the situation and resulted in the current charges are this documentary produced by the Lifetime Channel, Surviving R. Kelly, that tracked down a whole lot of victims and convinced them to come forward and tell their stories one after the other of how, you know, R. Kelly met them when they were underage and convinced them to leave school, come move in with him, and direct their every movement. And they can't even leave. They can't, you know, have a meal. They can't go to the bathroom. They need to ask permission to go to the bathroom. I'd encourage everyone, you know, just Google it, go online or go on Lifetime Channel, watch Surviving R. Kelly. It's 6 hours. And once you start watching, you watch all 6 hours. It just, you know, pulls you in. And it really paints a very convincing picture that convinced our local Cook County State's Attorney, right, Kim Fox, to say, if there are any victims out there that want to contact my office, we'd be, you know, interested in hearing from you. And that resulted in ten charges of aggravated criminal sexual abuse by four different, you know, victims, involving four different victims, three of them underage.
We were talking to Abden Palish, who's a journalist, who was one of the journalists who worked on the R. Kelly story long before this, you know, really became something that captured so many people's attention, even though it did in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And I want to come back in a moment and talk about what that circus was like, because I, you know, was just rereading your piece that you brought with you about people basically treating it like a field trip to go to R. Kelly's court date with kids and have them serenade him while he's, you know, walking to the courthouse. So let's talk a little bit more when we come back. And I also want to talk about why, you know, it is actually important to you know, continue the conversation, not just about R. Kelly, but about listening to, you know, when there are alarm bells, mm-hmm, when you think there's something wrong. And you know, I know that people get inundated with this conversation. They're like, "Oh, I don't want to hear about this anymore." But that's how predators like this thrive, you know, and the hubris that he really accumulated over, you know, when, like he said, "I beat these charges before," didn't mean that you were innocent.
Right.
You know, and I think that fed into his ego and really made things so much more horrific as the years went by. More in a moment on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me is journalist Abden Palish, who is also the director of communications for Controller Susana Mendoza. And he was one of the writers, one of the journalists who broke the story about R. Kelly and his abuse and really horrible, monstrous behavior when it came to young girls back in 2002?
2000 was our first story.
2000 was your first,
yeah,
story.
19 years.
And when you wrote that story, what was the reaction from readers? Were you getting any letters or any pushback from the paper itself?
You know, most of it was positive, appreciative for us doing the story, but there was a very strong pushback. R. Kelly had a very strong fan base, still does have a strong fan base, that doesn't want to believe the worst about him, and they push back hard. And of course, at that point, R. Kelly, you know, riding much higher in his career, had the best lawyers and PR machine that money could buy, and mm-hmm, they fought back hard against us. There was actually, when the first lawsuit was filed against him by one of the victims, they preemptively, as soon as she filed a lawsuit, they preemptively filed a countersuit saying she's a gold digger, and they were able to, the only story that was written at the time was one trashing her that they were able to engineer.
Man, it's so surreal to think that in 2000, you know, folks were trying to draw attention to this. You, the victims, you know, and you know, eventually it led to charges, but then was he acquitted?
He was acquitted.
He was acquitted.
It was a jury trial. You know, I was watching there's a much different judge on that case than there is in this case. That judge basically threw out everything that Jim and I had written about, all the priors, the entire pattern of conduct that R. Kelly had established to show this is how he treats girls, this is what he does. None of that was admitted. It was the judge made them try this in a vacuum, just one tape, and the girl, the victim, was not in court. So in closing argument, lawyer Sam Adam Jr. shouted the closing argument, said, "I want you to look out there, and I want you to look at," and he pointed out there to look at the girl, who of course wasn't there, mm-hmm. and I saw some jurors crane their necks forward and turn and look to see, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to be acquitted.
Wow, right.
And he was. And you look back now and you think, now if only the prosecutors made a noble effort over the 6 years, even as the judge, every ruling went against them that they couldn't, you know, introduce this stuff. If they had been able to assemble all the evidence that the producers of this documentary did, all the interviews with all these victims showing such a consistent pattern of conduct of what he does, we might have had a different verdict. We may have been able to avoid 11 more years of victims in the interim. And, you know, the story you were talking about here, this the kids serenading R. Kelly, you know, they drive a school bus
bizarre.
Up here of kids and have them sing I Believe I Can Fly as R. Kelly is walking in for a hearing on charges of, you know, child pornography. Not exactly the kind of thing most of us would want to send our kids on a field trip to. There were so many scenes like that over the 6 years. And then there's also the scene of this the victims, a 15-year-old girl who, you know, was there cheering on R. Kelly, who is now one of the victims in this case. She's one of the girls he's charged with, you know, sexually abusing in this case.
Did you think at some point that this would just never come back, you know, to justice, that we would ever be at this point where finally, and yes, it did take surviving R. Kelly, as you mentioned, yeah. a lot of the victims who were willing to be interviewed and that their stories were consistent with each other and the pattern of behavior, how he would victimize them. Were you concerned that there would never be justice?
It certainly seemed like, I think R. Kelly thought that he'd gotten away with it.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty clear. One of the most fascinating articles in the last few weeks is Neil Steinberg in the Sun-Times had an interview with R. Kelly's then lawyer, Ed Jensen, who's in very ill health and you know, we got to talk to Ed, you know, while he's still with us. But he had said that R. Kelly, Neil asked him, was he guilty of sin? And R. Kelly, and Jensen said, yes, he was guilty of sin. Well, how do you know? Well, because Ignition, he was just come out with that song at the time the trial was going on, and Jensen says initially this was a song about a high school driver's ed instructor getting it on with his high school students, and Jensen made R. Kelly rewrite the lyrics to Ignition, saying, "No, this is going to get you in trouble. I'm trying to get you an acquittal here." So who knew that the words to Ignition, the song that most of us could probably repeat a lot of the lyrics to, was rewritten by R. Kelly's criminal defense lawyer at the time.
Oh my God! Yeah, I had no idea about any of that. What do you say? Because, you know, our producer Ro Coleman and our newsman Vic Vaughn did a three-part series on R. Kelly. And Ro, and I'll ask both of you, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I'm so tired of hearing about this story. What are your thoughts on that? Ro, I'll ask you first. When people say, you know, I don't want to hear any more about this, it's been, you know, enough's enough. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
I think that if people felt that way when this first started breaking, that we wouldn't have to talk about it now.
Right.
But because, like, you know, like Abden said, nobody really cared very much. Plus all the music that he was dropping during the time, you know, the money that he had to be able to kind of hush these women. Nobody talked about it. So now here we are 20 years down the line, you know, X amount of years down the line since this first broke. And it's all over the place. Plus the Me Too movement is out. So that's just amplifying it even more and more. And I just really hope that people get it in their minds that this could be, if as a woman, this could have been you,
mm-hmm.
this could have been your sister, and for anybody else, this could have been your mom or your sister or, you know, the women that you love. So you really can't be that insensitive just to say, you know, shut it up or I don't want to hear it anymore.
Right, you're right. If someone in your family was victimized, would you want it to go away?
Everybody would be kicking and screaming. They would want the world to know what's going on because they want justice, just like the women here.
Right.
And I think, as you say, Ro, the Me Too movement has performed such a service in educating all of us, me included, about how, you know, a grown woman can be manipulated to feel that she can't leave a bad situation. That, you know, the Harvey Weinstein stories, the Bill Cosby stories, mm-hmm. have really changed the national discussion, and I hope understanding of this issue.
I think it's gonna take a lot more work, and you know, and there are so many moments where I see it sliding back. I mean, and, you know, the ball has moved a little bit farther down the field, and people are aware, but in so many ways, there I think that, you know, women who experience it on a personal level, on a day to day level, are too afraid, or think, well, you know, that's because they're famous, or they have, you know, their jobs, or they're in a personal relationship where they feel like they don't have a way out. So I hope you're right. But I think, you know, shedding a light on situations is meaningful and important, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have daughters?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. And not that you have to have a daughter. And I always see those moments where, like, you don't have to have a daughter to get it, but it must hit so much more intensely. So
it has certainly prompted some discussions at the Palish household. You know,
yeah,
I haven't had my, you know, teenage daughter watch all 6 hours of this documentary, but I've told her, you know, here's situations that, you know, you'll face through your lifetime, and, you know, she's got a level head on her shoulders. I think she'll be all right.
Do you have any interest in staying for one more segment? I know
sure.
I just got a question from a texter, and I also want to talk about maybe some work that you're doing in Springfield with the controller.
Sure.
And what's in store for 2019. More in a moment on 720 WGN. We're hanging out with journalist Abdon Palish, and he was one of the journalists who worked on the R. Kelly story back in 2000 with the Chicago Sun-Times with Jim DeRogatis. More in a moment. As Vic Vaughn was saying in the news broadcast, R. Kelly has a day in court and coming up in just a few hours, and he's trying to go to Dubai because he says he needs the money, and it was a already established appearance that he had. And in studio with us, we have Abdon Palish, who was one of the journalists working on the R. Kelly story in 2000. And help break the story with Jim DeRogatis. I'm just looking online at so many stories from before this year, before the documentary Surviving R. Kelly, yeah. Whether it was Back to You and Jim back in 2000 and all the court dates. And then again in 2013, that, you know, they're like, people are like, why are people finally paying attention to these accusations? And it still was 6 years later after that article, and yeah. I'm sure many in between. And Abdon, you know, watching it unfold, having had all the conversations that you did, you must have heard just so many wild things beyond what the horrible acts were that he was degrading and abusing and assaulting these young girls. But also the reaction from the public that was just kind of like, meh. So one of the listeners asked, well, where were the parents? And that's come up quite a bit. What are your thoughts on, yeah. when you hear questions like that?
And, you know, some of the parents have been interviewed in just in the last few months, especially the parents of the girls who are now of age. They're living with R. Kelly. And, you know, they did an interview with Gayle King where they criticized their parents, and they looked like they'd been coached on exactly what to say. And, it's painful to watch that. And you're hoping that, you know, if R. Kelly does get, you know, convicted and go away, and maybe these girls now get the deprogramming they need, that they can be reunited with their parents. And some of them have. And Jim just had an interview in The New Yorker with one of the girls who recently was liberated from the R. Kelly encampment there at the Trump Hotel in Chicago, and is now back in a good relationship with her parents, you know, and she'd not been allowed to talk to them for years. But it's tough coming back from that, you know, and she's still, you know, yeah. somewhat in denial. So R. Kelly, and if you watch this documentary, which I encourage everybody to watch, the Surviving R. Kelly documentary, all 6 hours, it'd be worth your time. But girl after girl explains, you know, R. Kelly, he looks through the crowd and looks for the underage girl that he thinks he will best be able to manipulate, someone without any authority figure standing nearby, someone maybe, you know, the daughter of a working mom who's not going to notice if the girl's staying out late at his studio every night, that won't have some strong family member to advocate for them. He's had a lot of trial and error over the, you know, last couple of decades to get this process right. I mean, it's a fair question. A lot of the parents ask themselves, why didn't they notice? You get this both in the R. Kelly and, you know, the Michael Jackson documentary that's out right now about parents saying, you know, why was I allowed to be, why did I let myself be fooled into letting my child spend so much time with a celebrity?
You know, what just struck me as you were talking about, you know, people say, where were the parents? I had spoken to Karen Conti, who her husband Greg Adamski had worked on John Wayne Gacy's hearings about, you know, wanting to get off the death row. They were fighting the death penalty, and they were telling me this story about, you know, I didn't do this, but if I did, where were the parents? So when you have a sociopath like that asking the same question folks are asking about these parents, I mean, like, you know what? Question answered. Here's somebody who's manipulative, who knows, it just has a way of, because he did the same thing. He would find boys who were perhaps, you know, whether they were runaways or they were, you know, wanted a party and all kinds of things. It's a similar, so, you know, it's hard to hear someone say, where were the, you know, when we have a monster like R. Kelly out there. And you know what? It's also, even I just use a word that is, so strange, because every time something bad happens, we talk about evil or a monster. And, you know, it sort of negates the fact that this isn't the only part. R. Kelly's not the only one out there doing something like this. Right. This happens. And evil is a sort of a simple way to dismiss it and put it away somewhere. And that's again, why it's important to talk about it.
And you know, Jim and I, from the very first story we did 19 years ago, we talked about all the Hollywood celebrities. You know, Gary Glitter, Roman Polanski, you know, Harvey Weinstein's finally gotten his comeuppance. You know, this R. Kelly's not the first.
Right.
And it's just, he's one of our hometown guys that's got more of our attention. And this issue had gone uncovered for so long that we felt the obligation to cover it. In the same way, you know, the Catholic Church is finally getting, you know, the attention it deserves. And it's a minority of priests, but thank God that a lot of the offenders have now been found out and taken out of circulation instead of being transferred from parish to parish. So it's a long overdue day of reckoning coming for a lot of these offenders.
It's almost as though it's too icky to want to think about or address, or because there are even parents who knew that their children were being abused in the same, whether it was by the clergy or again, as we're talking about this case with R. Kelly. What do you think about R. Kelly wanting to leave the country and go to Dubai?
You know, on the one hand, you know, I'm sure if I'm him, I'm arguing, well, you know, you want me to pay child support, so let me go make the money. That's great. But how about all the money you're paying for that great pad you got at the Trump Hotel, you know, with the girls who you don't let talk to their parents? Maybe, you know, get a more reasonably priced rent somewhere out in the neighborhoods and actually pay your child support obligations to your kids. You know, is that an option? The judge will hear the arguments back and forth on court on whether or not he lets him go to the United Arab Emirates, which does not have an extradition treaty with the United States.
Convenient.
So...
I would find it reprehensible if the judge let him go.
That was one of the first things the judge did, was confiscate his passport when he was, you know, sent to jail on these charges several weeks ago.
Yeah, no, that doesn't make any sense. I want to thank you, Abden, for hanging out with us. I also wanted to know if we could talk a little bit about your, by the way, Ro and Vic, I know Vic's in the newsroom from the 301. Excellent work by Ro and Vic. And thanks to all those who persisted in not letting this go. Kelly needs to be behind bars. These monsters make me sick.
Thank you.
Yeah, we need to have these conversations. And you've worked in journalism. You're now the director of communications for Controller Mendoza.
Yeah.
We ran into each other a couple times in Springfield. You guys are always on the move, always busy doing a lot of work.
I think the controller, and by any measure, has done more with this office than any of her predecessors. You know, to pass so many bills, opening the transparency of the office, so you can now, you know, go on our website and see so much more than you ever could before about the state spending, the state's unpaid bills, the Debt Transparency Act that we passed made public so much more that the legislators did not know when they were crafting budgets just how much, you know, the unpaid bills were, and
right.
Now they know, so they can take that into account when they make the budgets. We got another bill I'll make a plug for right now called Bank on Illinois, so that folks right now that they go to currency exchanges or, you know, payday lenders instead of, this would be aimed at those folks to try and get them into regular banking, so that you'd be able to go on our website and see, okay, here in your hometown, your bank has these accounts which, you know, don't require a minimum deposit. You know, you can get a checking account, you can keep a low balance. And this has been used in other states and shown great effect in eliminating what for a lot of people can be $40,000 over a lifetime of these fees from the predatory lenders. That you pay from not having a regular bank account, encouraging folks to get into, you know, a reasonable banking situation. So talk to your legislators, support the controller's Bank On legislation.
And look, everyone's got different opinions and thoughts on our politicians and the work that they do. I know that there were differences of opinions about, you know, during the budget impasse, there were legislators who were like, she's not, you know, she's not going to pay our, you know, our checks. you know, and that had left people with a bad taste in their mouth. But then I was out to lunch with somebody who works with community services, and they provide therapy and social work to families who have individuals with disabilities. And I've talked to other people, and they were so grateful that when, you know, they needed to be able to maintain the services, that Controller Mendoza made sure that those who work so hard to take care of our most vulnerable were paid.
Yeah. If you talk to any of the, you know, nonprofits or small businesses around the state who get paid by the state, I think they're pretty grateful that after 2 years of budget impasse when they weren't getting paid, when Controller Mendoza took office 2 years ago, you know, I was with her. We've gone all over the state talking to these folks, and she's kind of like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, saying, okay, I can't give you everything the state owes you, but how much can I give you to get by and make sure you don't miss payroll next week?
Oh,
you
know? Funny.
So we have those conversations, and it's getting a little better. We're still not out of the woods yet. We still, as of today, have a backlog of unpaid bills of $8.5 billion. You know, the various proposals.
Well, we were up to, wasn't it up to like 12 or 13?
It was up to $16.5 billion until about a year and a half ago, when the controller really pushed the governor to take advantage of the authority that the legislature had given him to borrow, to refinance the debt.
Right.
So we were paying 12% interest on some of this debt, and we brought it down to 3.5%, which is going to save Illinois taxpayers like $4 billion to $6 billion over the course of the bonds. So
that's important work. I think people
still realize. $8.5 billion. We still got a lot of work to do, but it's going in the right direction.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Abden. We'd love to have you back in. And of course, the controller is welcome. I know it's late at night and she's got a lot to do, and so do you. So
she'll be back.
Yeah, she was last time she was on the phone, but that's okay. It's all right.
We'll bring it.
Well, thank you so much, and safe drive home. I know that you didn't wear a coat, and I'm a little bit confused. I know that everyone's moved on to winter. Okay, before we go to the break, let me just ask this: have you put away your winter clothes yet?
Oh, hell no.
Because are you worried?
It's Chicago. We have April snowstorms here.
I know. And I'm also, I've been told that if I do, I'll jinx it and we'll have a snowstorm if I put it away. You believe that that's accurate?
Keep everything. I don't believe we're out of the woods yet.
All right. 312-981-7200. I want to hear if everyone else is packing up their winter stuff or if I've jumped the gun. All right. Thank you so much, Abby.
Always have a pleasure,
great
Patty.
Of course. More after this on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. Let me know. Did you pack the mittens away?